Just because the drinking stops doesn't mean the dysfunction does. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shitshows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shitshow. I am an adult child of an alcoholic and dysfunctional family. I'm a recovering alcoholic myself. And this is the podcast for when you realize that your childhood is wreaking havoc on your life as an adult. The podcast where we talk about serious shit, but we don't take ourselves too seriously, that is actually fun to listen to. The podcast where we don't sugarcoat things or pretend like we have it all together. And most importantly, embrace the fact that this healing journey is messy as fuck. And yes, we curse here. You've been warned. I'm an acquired taste. You've been warned. So today we are revisiting an episode that is just your classic adult child story that is equal parts heartbreaking, hilarious, and healing. This is with fellow adult child, Francisco. You ever meet someone and within 5 minutes you're like, oh yeah, we had the same childhood? Well, that's what this episode is. No experts, no therapists, just two shit shows swapping stories about alcoholic parents, dysfunctional relationships, getting sober young, and the long ass road of learning how to feel safe and comfortable in your own skin. So if you've ever questioned whether you're the only one who's dated emotionally unavailable people, why you overfunction in relationships, or why sobriety or the 12 steps alone has not been enough to quote unquote fix you, then this conversation is going to hit you. We talk grief, breakups, relapse, how to stop abandoning yourself in the name of people pleasing. And just a beautiful reminder, as I already said, that this healing journey is messy as hell. So on that note, let's get on with the damn show. But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you need to damn the Join Shit Show, my online support community, where I host 4 weekly Zoom support groups. We have a minimum of 6 groups per week. You can find a calendar of all of our groups on my website on adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow if you're wondering what the times are. This is a support community at your fingertips, in your back pocket, that you can access through our app or on your computer 24/7. Any damn time you need us, we're here. You need a little support, you need a little pick-me-up, you need a place to vent, you need some advice, you need to share that picture of your cat, you need to share that win. Whatever it is, we're here. This is truly a community. This is like going to a meeting with all your favorite people. No fuddy-duddies around this place, okay? No fuddy-duddies. So you, yes, you, the person that's been wanting to join for fucking ever. And I know there's so many of you because so many of you have joined that say that. And I know that there's so many more. And I know you're scared to death to do it. I know that it is scary as hell to hop aboard this hot mess of a ship, but I'm telling you, it's going to be so worth it. So I just ask that you take a leap of faith today. You take that courage and you damn the Join for less than $1 a day. You can quit after a month. Adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow. You're missing out. You really are. I'm telling you, you're missing out. This is the place to be to heal. Next, give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at adultchildpod. And last but not least, whatever you do, please, please, please give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. Thank you. Love you all.
Well, it is my pleasure to introduce a former shit show, just like me, and somebody who really has done the work and is continuing to do the work. And that's why I really wanted to have him on the pod today. So welcome, Francisco.
Hi, pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for asking me.
Yeah, pumped to have you. So our stories are similar in the sense that you got sober and like me, did you think that that was the main problem?
Oh, absolutely. I had no idea what an ACA was, or, just like, it's kind of like recovery is like, there's an episode of The Simpsons where Homer climbs this mountain and he gets to the top and he looks and there's like three other summits waiting for him. And that is how I feel recovery is. Once you take the summit and it's like, oh, wait, there's another fucking peak.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me about it. But it's good. It's continued opportunities for growth. So before we get into your upbringing, I want to hear about how you hit your adult child bottom. I think we also were similar too, and kind of had the realization, didn't take it too seriously, and then had to suffer some more pain before we were really willing to do the damn work. So tell me about how you realized that you were an adult child.
Well, yeah, I think that it is one of those things where sometimes if you are in another 12-step group, in my experience, in my case, AA, people talk about the onion, right? That there's layers to the onion and you have to peel the onion, and which is true for everybody, all alcoholics, but for us who are ACAs, some of those layers of the onion end up being the ACA work. And I had no idea that's what it was until I got to it. But basically my ACA bottom was that I had gotten sober and had gone through the 12 steps of AA, and I was doing the deal, as we say. And at a certain point around year four or year five, that's when I had to walk through the ACA bottom. And it was a long bottom because it was a point where I had stayed sober long enough for the things that I used to drink over to come bubbling up and to stay there. Mm. And the thing is about it, I wasn't medicating to get rid of those feelings or to ignore them or just to manage them. And because of that, I was using the tools of AA and I wasn't drinking over them. That is very effective for that, but for the actual addressing where those feelings came from, AA wasn't quite doing it. So
how did you feel during those first 4 years? I mean, were you happy, joyous, and free?
Well, I was getting there. I felt like I was on the road, right? Because when you're first newly sober, all the new experiences you have, and I think that's like a human tendency, is like new experiences kind of take you out of self, take you out of your ego, and they it was a bit of the pleasure principle, right? Which is like, oh, this is cool, this is nice. And then it's easier to get into gratitude about things like, oh, I'm not in jail, I'm not waking up with a crippling hangover. I can go to dinner and not drink. I can go and meet new people and not drink. I can go anywhere and not drink. I can sign up for classes at the community college. I can even get decent grades. Just like the stuff, like basically I've heard from old timers in AA that it's like, yeah, the first few years, it's like just learning how to put on your shoes and dress yourself and just live life. And so those things were happening, and there was some really cool stuff happened in my first couple of years of sobriety, which showed me like you can actually have a happy life. You can actually have a good life. It's not necessarily, you're not set out to be a miserable person necessarily. Especially the alcohol problem was the biggest issue in my life. It was the thing that was poisoning all other aspects. So once I got rid of that, things were starting to go well. And I think really my ACA bottom was connected to what's a relationship, really.
Oh, wow. You must be the only one.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Like I didn't have a, what was it for you with two mics?
Two Brians.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't have two Brians, but I was tending to be attracted to the same type of person over and over again.
First question, did you date in early sobriety?
No, I didn't. And that's, I feel like I'm like a rare forest elf that in that aspect, because most people would jump in it. I was really frustrated about that. Okay. Like, it was just like, why me? And On the other side of it, I realized that it was actually my higher power working in my life and keeping me going, you know, this guy, he can't do that. He can't walk through that and not drink. So, because if I had gone through dating without knowing who I really was, knowing what my past patterns were, what from my childhood trauma was coming up in relationships, if I had gone through dating and not known any of that, I would have been in so much pain that I would have picked up a drink no matter what other tools I had at my disposal. That's what I think.
I don't know how I stayed sober. Like, I don't have any fucking clue. Okay. So it's coming up in relationships.
Yeah. It came up in relationships because it was also because like a year four, I was like, well, gee, like, well, look, my life is getting pretty good. I'm starting to progress in things. But why haven't I gotten a relationship? What was that about?
Mm-hmm.
And so it came to a point where I started getting interested in a couple of people, and just like the pain over not having that reciprocated put me in a spiral where it was like my sponsor, my AA sponsor, said, okay, I think that you need to get some outside help for that. And I had no idea what he was talking about, but he's been around a long time, so he's seen a lot of things. So. And he actually had another person in the fellowship who went to therapy to address some of these things. And so I started going to therapy with him. And that's where I discovered my inner child, because I had no idea what it was. Mm-hmm. I had no idea what this wound was, that it was this lack of feeling like I was not dateable, or this feeling that I was not able to be in a relationship. Was linked to abandonment. It was linked to not getting that base level of love that we're supposed to get in our childhoods. And that's what, I had no idea that's what it was, but when I started doing therapy, specifically to address these things, I started to connect the dots.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, another friend of mine, because it was like, it's like when an AA, when you start to drink with, or you find lower companions, you find people who drink like you.
Mm-hmm.
I found people in recovery who were also ACA.
Yeah.
And we all just, you know, did what we do and replicated our toxic patterns with each other. Codependency and being abusive to each other, and you know, like, we were all still trying our best, and we were still trying to work the AA program around everything, and some are still around, some are not, because that's the nature of addiction, but it was something I was like, oh, okay, so that was an ACA thing, where you tend to vibe with other ACAs, and one of them, she said, oh, I found this program, that I think it's really going to be next level. And she showed me the laundry list. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Cool. But anyways, and then let's move on.
Yeah, you read the third one. You're like, nope, I'm good.
Yeah, I glanced at it and I'm like, okay, I can see myself in some of these. Of course, when I started working the steps, I found myself in all of them, because we have to break out of that denial. But initially, I mean, it's worth a touch on, because that was the first wins I heard about what ACA was. And then at the same time, I started doing this therapy, and my therapist, he sat me down in this little chair that's built for a kindergartner. And he asked me, as if I was a kid, like, you know, what do you like to play with? And I'm like, oh, Ninja Turtles. And all of a sudden I started crying, and I had no idea why. And I didn't even feel sad or anything. It was just like, kind of like, I don't know. It reached something that had been always been there. And from there, I started doing work with him, started doing a lot of the stuff that actually is in the Big Red Book about reaching the inner child. So that's one of those things where like a higher power showed up in my life, and that I got to do all that before I even got into the program. Eventually, Yeah, I just I started working the ACA steps because I was in enough pain and the therapy was helping, but I knew that ACA was it. I knew that I had to go through those steps. And there's one particular period where I felt really, really alone and apart and different and just like a complete freak of nature, even in AA. Like, and then I think there was like some social event that people were gonna do, and I just did not. I just like I felt absolutely horrible because I didn't feel like I could be a part of it. And you know, of course, there's another potential person that I was interested in, and completely not emotionally available, or even oblivious to the fact that I was interested. But and I think they ended up in ACA as well, of course. But but I remember I called my sponsor in AA, and I'm just like, I'm at a breaking point. I don't know what I'm gonna do. And he's like, go to a meeting. And I'm like, I don't want to go to a meeting. Like, it stopped working. It doesn't work anymore. And I show up at this random meeting. I'm like, okay, just get to a meeting. And I show up at this random meeting, and there's somebody there who is an AA old timer, and he's talked about how he had a nervous breakdown late in his sobriety. And then he discovered this program called ACA. And he said, a lot of old timers have untreated mm-hmm. ACA issues. And of course, because I had already been doing the inner child work and therapy, and I had, I had been exposed because of my friends to this program a few months before that. I was like, okay. So I asked him to sponsor. Oh, no. What happened with that is, he and I fellowshipped after, so we went to see a movie and we went to get pizza, and we were walking, and this person that I'm interested in just like randomly pops out and says hi to both of us. And I'm just like, ah! So I just tell him everything. And then he's like, what's your relationship like with your parents? And I'm just like, oh, no, it's fine, it's great, it's great. You know, like I made amends to them, and I'm sober, so I'm sure they're happy, and blah 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 blah. And it was. I'm like, eventually, like a couple weeks later, I was like, yeah, I'm an ACA. And so I asked them to sponsor me, and we went through the steps.
So I want to backtrack some, because I've talked a lot about my insanity in romantic relationships and the type of people I was attracted to. I don't think I haven't really dove into it too much with a male guest. So I want to hear about tell me about your broken picker. What were you attracted to? And then how did that manifest? Explain what it was like, you know, cause your sponsor is telling you that you need to seek outside help. So how did your peace of mind get hijacked? What did that look like for you?
I think that I'm primarily, well, we try to find people who are like our parents, right? So I just gravitated toward people who were emotionally unavailable, who also had ACA issues, who were manipulative, and who just were not communicative at all with their feelings.
Are you an anxious attacher?
I'm not sure I heard that term before.
It's kind of like the codependent versus the avoidant attacher is the one who's more emotionally disconnected. Yeah, like whenever we sense that somebody's like pulling away, then we act, you know, more and call more, and versus an avoidant more so when they start to feel that the other person is emotionally attaching to them, then they pull away.
Oh, no, I'm definitely the first one.
Okay. Yes. Anxious. I assume.
I think I got that from my mother, because my dad left her early on mm-hmm. In the first year of my life. And then they got back together, and then he came to the United States. So my mother went through two huge waves of abandonment, and her father was an alcoholic. So of course she never got the love that she needed from him. And so I think that was passed on to me, and completely just barnacling onto a person. Mm-hmm. And I paddle, actually, we're coming up on the 13th anniversary of me going to jail.
Oh, lovely.
And what happened there was because I was interested in someone in my active addiction, and I drank at her when she did not reciprocate. Because of course she was a heavy drinker herself, and oh yeah, and that's the other thing too. I'm attracted to other people who drink and use like I did.
Yes.
And so of course I end up in a blackout and I wander into an open garage and and then police are called, and long story short, I spent a week in there. And so again, this was all over my feelings of not being loved and over another person. So I was definitely, and before that I was a nightmare. I was like blowing up her phone and just like not being having a rational response to someone not being interested in you. And we actually texted earlier today. She's still a friend.
Oh, so good.
I've done the work, and I actually keep her at a bit of a distance.
Yeah. Is she sober?
It's like, what? No. It's like at this point, it's kind of like one of those things where it's like, if you've known someone since like you were 15 or 16, I value her presence in my life, but it's the appropriate presence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I've learned how to do that because of ACA.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can really relate to what you said about just how getting sober, it's almost like, yeah, it's like the drinking the drugs, right? That's like medicating the adult child issues. It's like putting a Band-Aid on a wound in a sense. And it is like when we get sober, it's like slowly ripping off that Band-Aid. And for me, I really feel like it allowed those issues to really start festering and growing, you know, and it was, it got progressively worse for me, just like my alcoholism did. So I feel grateful that it manifested in such a dramatic way for me. Cause I feel like what that old timer said, about how there's so many untreated, adult children that are old timers. I feel grateful that my issues manifested in such a painful way that it was like, it was unavoidable. Like there was no denying it or hiding it versus other adult children to where their issues, their symptoms might be a lot more subtle. And they never really come to, hit a bottom, or get to the place where they're willing to do the work to change. So, I feel grateful that I was as big of a shit show, as I was.
me too. Cause I got a head start on things. I feel like, because I started getting ACA when I was in year 4 or 5. But the other side of it is I had to be enough pain for that. And the reason for that was because these wounds were so large.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been sober now?
I will have 12 years in July.
Nice. That's great. Okay, so let's backtrack now to childhood. What is your earliest memory?
Actually, my earliest memory is Hurricane Hilbert.
Oh. Where did you grow up?
Happened, I think, in 88. I was born in the Yucatan Peninsula, in Mérida, the capital.
Uh-huh.
That's in Mexico, and I moved to the United States when I was 5. But my first memory was, I think that we moved out of my house, or we were being moved to another place. I just remember outside, and I just remember the trees going sideways, and the rain going sideways. And then I'm just in some place with in a bed with a blanket on me, and that was it. And it's kind of like, okay, that's an apt metaphor, because that's kind of like the chaos, the backdrop of chaos that informed my childhood and informed my life. That was my first memory. But then a lot of my memories from my time in Mexico were just a lot of melancholia. Like a feeling of sadness, like a feeling of aloneness. And I think that in hindsight, well, like I mentioned before, my dad wasn't around first because of this thing that I had not found out about until 2015, because don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. And big family secrets. And my mom, doing the best she could, just could not adequately give us the love that we needed, me and my older sister.
Are you going to tell us what this big secret is?
That was the big secret, that my dad left my mom briefly.
Oh, left her. Okay. So you didn't, okay. You didn't have memories of that.
No, because I was very young. It was not too long after I was born.
Okay. And then he reappeared at what point? 5 years old?
He reappeared maybe when I was two or three.
Okay. Got it.
But then not long after that, he decided that he needed to come to the U.S.
Okay.
His brothers had my uncles, some of them had already started coming here. So he went here to check it out. And then it was just like a perfect timing with the Reagan amnesty that had started to get going in the late 80s in California. And he just realized he could, you know, make a better chance of things for us if he stayed there. So it was just like I said, a two punch abandonment for me and my family. For Harris, first him and for my mother, first him leaving and then him leaving again. Even though the second one was completely different, but again, you know, like your inner child does not understand things like that. Mm-hmm. So for her, it must have been like that abandonment that she felt in childhood from my grandfather reassessing itself. And of course, we did not understand any of this, and we never understood it because we didn't talk about these things. Mm-hmm. And
so then how long was he here before you and your mom? And you have siblings, you have a sister, right?
I have a sibling who had an older sister and the younger sister. The younger one was born in the U.S.
Okay.
And the older one obviously was born in Mexico about a year and a half before I did. I was, and my mother also suffered a miscarriage before that, which she never looked at or addressed because, you know, these are things that you're just expected to sweep under the rug and stiff upper lip and, of course, there's all these issues, but with my mom being a woman and being alone, and you know, it was a really difficult go of it for her, and that was passed on to us because she was just so preoccupied with her abandonment and that she wasn't able to properly give us the attention or socialize us properly as well. I remember that we just spent a lot of time alone. And then, like, one of my dad's visits from the U.S., he brought me an NES, and that was my primary caregiver. And that was my first addiction as well. I would, like, live on that thing. And I actually, and this is my mom's...
Is that the original Nintendo?
The original Nintendo with Super Mario. And I just, like, would play that thing religiously. And my mom's codependence, and this kind of shows her parenting style, she would fuss and moan about me on that thing, but there was nothing else to do. And she would actually be spoon feeding me dinner while I was playing. So I'd be like playing, lean over, take a bite, keep playing. And that's, so I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's a pretty big ACA upbringing. And that's kind of, again, that attachment that we talked about, which I replicated with people I was interested in, that was seen there because my mom's like, oh my God, I have to cater to this person's desires and wants. Mm-hmm. And she was already laminating that from her father to my dad to me.
Mm. So you called her Princess Peach?
She was Toadstool.
Toadstool, okay.
She was Toadstool in the for us. I think Peach, they started doing that in the late 2000s.
Later. Okay. So then how long was your dad in the U.S. before you guys made the trek?
My dad was in the U.S. I think a few years. Like we came in 91.
And where did you come in California?
We ended up in the San Francisco Bay Area. San Rafael. So like my father's community in Mexico, in Pico, Yucatan, was they usually went to two different places, the Bay Area and Fort Bragg, the California one, not the North Carolina one. And so we ended up, and it's just like a classic immigrant story. You go where your family and your community ends up. So that's exactly what we did.
And you obviously didn't know any English.
No, I did not know a single word of English. I learned pretty fast, but again, that was a traumatic thing as well, because it's like you go to a place where you're already not socialized at all. You already feel like, I remember in Mexico, I tried to rally the neighborhood kids one time, and this lady like kind of like laughed at me, which she probably thought, oh, he's being cute. But for me, I felt like she was like, that like hit something, that like just feeling of inadequacy. And I think my mother was around, but she didn't say anything, or I didn't say anything either, because I had never learned to talk about my feelings or talk about how I felt. And so I still remember that, because again, that goes exactly to that feeling of like when I'm sitting there and feeling socially rejected, like I can't go to this AA thing, and it's like exactly that same button. And if I remember it from that early on, from year 3 or 4 of my life, and that is something that was passed on to me by my mother.
So then you get over here, and then, I mean, were there drugs and alcohol present in your home growing up as a kid?
No. And that's the thing about it, is my father was what I would call now a dry drunk. He had gone to AA in Mexico for a little bit. And he had gotten enough solution that he learned not to drink.
Was this before you were born?
This is around the time when I was born.
Okay.
So I never got the timeline down completely. These things are something that I've had to piece together.
I was going to ask you, how did you learn about this?
Yeah, I do remember my father would talk about, oh yeah, Alcoholics Anonymous, they helped me a lot when I was younger, and I was like 10 or 11 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And just because of just different pieces from my grandparents and from my mom, but I had never completely learned the whole story until I was able to do the ACA work and kind of put things in their place. So there was no drinking in the home, but my dad was a dry drunk because he had stopped working the program, and he is one of these people who I think just like we talk about, if you believe in AA tenets and in 12 steps, that if you don't work the program and you're a real alcoholic, you're going to exhibit alcoholic behavior sans alcohol. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, Al-Anons, poor Al-Anons suffer from alcoholism and they don't even drink. So
yeah,
that's a pretty bad deal. And,
yeah, no kidding.
And so, of course, my mother is a black belt untreated Al-Anon as well. And so it was like, and that was one of the things that really made me, I think I might have been on my 6th meeting of ACA, that really locked everything in for me, was the passage in the Big Red Book that says there's some of us who are grandchildren of alcoholics who still had the dysfunction passed on to us, even if there was no drinking in the home. Mm-hmm. Of course, for me, it was pretty obvious as well, because not only were both my grandparents alcoholics, but just the behaviors were completely alcoholic for my family.
And so then when did you start drinking?
I started drinking, well, first of all, I started pot when I was 14. And that kept me going. And it was still my preferred drug of choice until I stopped everything. But drinking itself, I did not start until I was 18.
Okay.
And then tried to get sober the first time at 21 after I got the legal consequences. And then after that, I got sober again at 24, and the second one has stuck so far.
Good. So was that 21 after you had the you got arrested in the garage?
Yeah, actually, that was happening a couple of days before my 21st birthday. And so, you know, you're an alcoholic when you can't even wait to get into jail until you can legally do so.
I've never even had a legal drink.
Yeah, some of us, we get started early.
Yeah, sure.
We're lucky we get to stop early too.
Uh-huh. So did you have consequences right away? Like when you started smoking pot, and like, what was your experience like during high school?
Well, I was already a horrible student, and so I didn't think I got consequences there, but I really just it completely overtook my life. I could not stand not being stoned until year 14 and 15, not so bad, but it was like, it's a progressive thing, right? So by year 17, I just was like not a functioning person at all in any sense of the word. And I could not stand not being stoned. And then of course, when I got 18, when I was 18, the first thing I did was get my cannabis card. And so that was a whole thing. And then 18 through 21, just drinking and consequences, blacking out, the usual alcoholic story.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would like to make a note here. You said you were a horrible student. I would like everybody to know that you are currently getting your PhD at an Ivy League school. So things turned out pretty okay for you. So,
yeah. Yeah, and I like to say that I was a high school dropout, and wow. It took me 6 years of community college and 2 relapses to finish my BA. And after that, yeah, decided to do the grad school thing.
So what role did you play in your family growing up? Were you the hero, the scapegoat, the lost child? What role did you play?
I was a mix of, I think, mostly the lost child and a little bit of the hero. Actually, my dad's nickname for me was his champion. My older sister is definitely the scapegoat. She continues to be the scapegoat because she struggles. And, you know, I have to do a lot of work around that one. But I also understand that being the firstborn, she caught the worst of it. And this is a generational thing. Just like my dad's brother, he was the firstborn and he caught the worst of it. He actually killed himself back in the mid-2000s. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this thing gets passed on. But I was the lost child because obviously my younger sister was the baby. She was the mascot. And my older sister was the scapegoat. And so being the middle child and also not having as much going on in terms of my acting out as my sister, I was kind of just there.
Yeah, with your Nintendo. Did you get a Super Nintendo?
I had upgraded to a Super Nintendo and then eventually an N64. So
okay, I think that N64 was like the best system ever. Now there's too many buttons on the damn things. I can't.
Yeah, plus you have to like upgrade every time you go, and like it takes another 15 minutes just to download the new software.
So with your alcoholism and addiction progressing, what was your family's role in it? Were they trying to get you sober, or were you kind of off on your own by that point? All right, shit show ladies. Have you ever had those days where everything just feels so much damn harder than normal and you can't figure out why? I already know the answer to that question is yes. And boy, have I definitely had more than my fair share of those days and totally get just how frustrating this can be. But recently, I've learned that sometimes it's not just stress, lack of sleep, a dysregulated nervous system. It could also be my hormones at play. And that is where Happy Mammoth comes in. They offer a free 2-minute quiz that can help you uncover the root cause of your hormonal symptoms. It's super easy. Any shit show can do it. Just answer a few questions about what you've been going through and where you're at in life. After taking this quiz, you'll get personalized recommendations to help balance your hormones and start feeling better. So I took this hormone quiz myself. The quiz suggested that my body may be overloaded with estrogen, which is affecting me in all kinds of ways. And one of the recommendations that I got was to start taking Hormone Harmony, which helps with bloating, chronic fatigue, weight gain, mood swings, and more. And after adding it to my routine, I've definitely noticed a difference. Now, taking care of your hormones isn't just about feeling good right now. It's also about investing in our healing journey. And so by taking this quiz, you'll learn more about your hormone balance, which will allow you to start making small, intentional changes to support you on this healing journey. Whether it's the Hormone Harmony or another Happy Mammoth product, the quiz helps guide you towards solutions that work specifically for you. So if you're ready to start feeling like yourself again, head over to happymammoth.com and take their free 2-minute hormone quiz today to find out the ultimate answer to your stubborn hormonal issues. And for a limited time, you can also get 15% off your entire first order with my code adultchild at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code adultchild for 15% off today.
Oh, well, no, because I actually, and this is another sign of our alcoholic dysfunction, is that I could not break away from home. I didn't leave home until I came to grad school.
Uh-huh.
What happened was that every time, even when I got sober, like, and I went and did a semester of undergrad, and I moved into a room that was adjacent to the university campus. Mm-hmm. And even then, my dad would fight me on it. He was definitely the savior in his family.
Mm-hmm.
And he would not let us do anything for ourselves, mm-hmm. or let us give us room to fall flat on our faces. He, like, when I talked to him, like, I should learn how to be independent. He's like, oh, no, why do you have to do that? You're fine here. Like, we take care of you. You don't have to pay rent. All that stuff, right? And like survival mechanisms, really. But at the same time, it just doesn't give you the room to grow up. And so in terms of my addiction, he would passive aggressively leave me AA pamphlets on my pillow, which anybody who's done any Al-Anon work, but no, you do not do that. You are just pushing people further away from the program. If you force them, or you cajole them, or you try to bargain with them. And he would bribe me to go to church by taking us out for pizza after, which is just a milder version of that. Mm-hmm. But that was kind of
I do love pizza.
Yeah, and that did work for a little bit. I mean, God bless him. He did his best, and that was actually, I remember, from my grandmother, who I visited just very recently, and she told me about when I was in jail, he basically forced her to go with him because he said, come with me so he can see you, and he feels bad, and he's shamed into getting sober, which was not good for any of us. It was not good for me, it was not good for him, it was not good for the poor old lady.
Yeah.
So it's like, let's kind of share the trauma all around.
Did he ever drink again? He remained dry for the rest of his life?
No, he actually picked up again, which I didn't hear about until maybe, he started drinking again when I was abroad in Mexico doing a study program. And I didn't know about it until like 4 years later.
Okay.
And so he had been drinking in secret all that time, which is another very ACA thing to do. It's don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. My mom knew about it. She didn't tell me about it, trying to spare my feelings. But of course, at that time, I had been sober long enough and I had started doing the ACA work. And I'm like, gee, this guy's a dry drunk.
Like, you find out he's been drinking. His
feelings. He's completely irritable, restless, discontent, not communicative at all. And then it's like, oh, well, he's been drinking. Okay. So he's not actually dry. He's just,
he's a wet drunk.
He's drunk again.
He's a drunk drunk.
So, yeah. And I think he did stop toward the end of his life. He stopped again, but like just by the white knuckling it. Same thing as my grandfather, actually. My grandfather stopped drinking, but just completely on self-will. And I was like, of course, part of me, my addictive side was like, well, maybe then I don't need the program. And then my grandmother right away said, oh yeah, his neuroses never left him, but he stopped drinking. That was great. And I was like, yeah. Okay, never mind. Yeah.
Thanks, grandma.
Yeah. So that's why I always have to be like, okay, recovery has to be holistic. It has to be everything. I can't just not drink, and I can't just not, or I can't just do ACA. I have to do both.
Yeah. I've thought about that some about, for some people, like, can they resolve their trauma and work through their shit and then be able to drink? If they think that that's, if the underlying cause of their alcoholism is their trauma. But I mean, for me, I don't have any fucking desire to drink like a normal person, you know, like I've never have, I have no desire to just have one or two drinks. And, yeah. So I know for me that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic for me.
Yeah, well, for me, that part is, I think I recently went over the steps of the sponsee, and we talked about the whole integration aspect of it. And for me, I feel like just going through the 12 steps in AA is the integration process we do for that particular laundry list trait. Mm-hmm. Because alcoholism is one of our laundry list traits as ACA. Mm-hmm. And some of them we can get rid of. Some of them we just have to turn the volume down. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, it gets turned way down most of the time, but it doesn't completely go away. And so for the integration part is staying sober and doing what we need to stay sober in that respect. And that, so that in that way, I reconcile both programs for myself.
Mm-hmm. So how long into, working ACA, did you start trying dating?
I think about a year in.
Okay.
I mean, I had been online on like online dating sites for a couple of years, but never really didn't devote too much effort into it. And also, I didn't actually I practiced what we call relationship anorexia. I was too scared to actually show up to a date because why would anybody love me? And so once I started doing the ACA stuff, and also, I was still managing these feelings of wanting to be with someone who was just completely not right for me. And that's one of the other things though about the people I used to choose is that they completely were not interested. So you kind of have to want to, you get the other person kind of has to show
a little bit of interest. Is that how it works?
Exactly. So I think about a year in, I started just going on coffee dates and here and there, but I didn't really feel like, I didn't get into an actual serious relationship until I moved out to Philadelphia. For grad school, and that was the perfect time too, because I was like, okay, you know what, I'm doing programs, I feel solid in my recovery, and I'm constantly in gratitude because, again, we're in that phase where everything's new, and I really feel like I'm moving forward with my life. And also, I have something to show. I remember when I was, again, that trip that I went on in Mexico, and I would go to AA meetings there, and of course I thought, every trip I took, I was like, ooh, maybe I'll find someone on this trip. And that never happened. But I remember this one old timer in Mexico, and he was just like, well, I have to build my house and build it up and do this and do that. And things that like made cultural sense there before I even thought about finding a wife. I'm like, finding a wife? What are you talking about finding a wife? And I'm like, building a house. So like, you know how much it costs to build a house in the United States? But what he was saying was, it's all in due time, and work on yourself and just become a whole ass person. And you're probably not going to attract someone until you are a whole ass person for yourself. Mm. And so I started feeling like I was reaching that when I came out for grad school. And lo and behold, 4 or 5 months later, I went on a date with someone who we were together for 4 years.
And what was that like for you in the beginning, in like the earlier stages of the relationship? Because I think, as I've said a lot before, I think we have to do part of the work being single and being alone, but then we have more work to do in a relationship. So what was that process like for you?
Well, the process, I say, was a testament to the ACA program in that it went remarkably well for the entire duration of the relationship. Wow. We didn't really start to get some of the stuff coming up until, the last year. Mm-hmm. But it was just more like, what I had learned in therapy as well is that this whole idea of finding your better half, you have to be a whole person. You have to build your life. And a relationship is really just to enhance it, just like anything else that you bring into your life. enhances it, whether it's work, whether it's friends, whether it's, you know, training for a marathon or doing an artistic project or any, or playing video games. Any of these things are really should be in the service of making your life richer and more fulfilling. And so a relationship is just one of those aspects. And it's kind of like the Venn diagram, is that the Venn diagram? The one of the two circles that overlap? Mm-hmm.
Yep, definitely. Yep.
Yeah, the overlap of the relationship should be actually really, really small. Mm-hmm. And I think ACA's tendency is that most of the circle is their circle as well.
it's just one damn circle.
It's one damn circle. Exactly. And so I was very cognizant of that going in. And so we kept our lives mostly separate for probably longer than we should have, because that was one of the other things is when we ended up the relationship, my life didn't change that dramatically. And I was like, gee, after 4 years, maybe we could have shared a little bit more.
Was she in recovery?
She was not in recovery. She was one of those rare people who just doesn't drink.
Wow.
And that
weirdo
actually was perfect. Yeah, right. But the important thing was that she was working on herself as well. And she did things that were not my realm of experience, but she accepted me for who I was, and that I had to do all this stuff. And that she recognized, okay, this person is doing what makes sense for them, and that is an attractive thing. And right back at her, she was working on herself. She had her own goals and priorities, and she was always open about what she was feeling and where she wanted to go with this. So all of that made it so that we had a very good relationship. And when there was friction, there was friction because there's friction in all human relationships. But even there was an opportunity to understand, what is this bringing up from my childhood, and what of my family trauma and dysfunction am I modeling in this relationship or in this behavior?
Do you have an example of that, you know, that was profound for you, or anything that you can think of?
Well, yeah, actually, last year during the election, she was working, she was pretty heavily involved in the elections here where I live. And of course, I ended up being the supportive partner. She had her local station, or her staging area near my apartment. So she's like, oh, can I just drop in real quick to just, you know, take a breather and get centered? And I'm like, yeah, of course. And she shows up and she's completely frazzled. And so I'm like, okay, well, anything I need, anything I can do, you know, be a service, right? Mm-hmm. And she's like, oh, I need to pick up groceries and blah, blah, blah. And like, we had made a plan to spend the night together and be at her place. And just because we just wanted to be together for whatever came, come whatever comes, right? And so I go get groceries, and I bike over there, which is like a 40-minute bike ride. I get there, and there's nobody at the house. And she said she had forgotten to tell the roommate that I was coming, and the roommate wasn't there. The roommate wasn't going to be there for like another couple of hours. So I literally felt left out in the cold. Mm-hmm. And so that brought up a lot, and I just said that at that point, untreated Francisco would have probably blown up at her and yelled and been accusatory and all that. But bringing my program to it, I was like, you know what, I need a bit of space to process, to think, to tend to my inner child wounds, because they've been really active. And I think kind of what I realized then too was like, oh wow, like I'm dating a people pleaser. I'm dating someone who takes on too much, who always has way too many balls in the air, and who can't say no to people when they ask them to do something. And I'm like, okay, that's interesting. Interesting that it comes up now. And what I came around to was, that's not, being kind is not a, it's not a horrible trait to have, but it just has to be something that people have to work on to temper and be kind in a way that makes sense. So in a sense, it was kind of like I was dating, I was modeling my mother and she was my father, because my father would give you the shirt off his back if it was 20 below. And what I've learned in ACA is like, no, you have to keep your shirt on. You can tell someone where to go get a shirt, but don't give them your shirt. And I'm like, okay, so I, and I'm my mother, because I'm completely dropping everything and dropping, losing my own sense of self to fulfill this person's needs. But the beautiful thing about it was, this was a low key example. And this was not something that was happening all the time. This wasn't, again, the Venn diagram. This wasn't a pattern that was our way of being with each other. That was just one incident where all this converged, and I was able to recognize that as well.
And so then, did that play into the demise of the relationship at all?
Maybe a little bit. I think that, well, really what the relationship, it's transitioned. I still feel like we're going to be in each other's lives in some sense, because there was no big destruction, no endpoint. She actually reached out to me earlier today. But it was more of a logistical sense, because we both have goals and we both know what we want out of our lives. And I know that I am here. When we got together, I said, I have two priorities. My first is my recovery, and my second is finishing my PhD program. Everything else comes after that. And that remains true. And her priority was to build what she's trying to build here in the city. And so, of course, once I'm done, I don't know where I'm going to end up. And she knew that she was going to stay here. So it's, and at this point, it's like, okay, if we stay together, we're not helping each other grow at this point. We are trying to avoid the painful process of breaking up. So we had an exit date as well. Like, cause I was like, okay, I'm going to go to California to do my field work. And that was scheduled for the summer of 2020. And we all know what happened then. And so the pandemic prolonged our relationship, and I'm grateful for that, because I had someone support me, and we could support each other in this incredibly rough time. But at the end of the day, that did not change the overall fundamental nature of our relationship, which was that I'm going to leave, she's going to stay, and we don't have enough of an interface where we could do the long distance thing. And and the months leading up to where we thought it was gonna, I was going to leave, we were having more and more problems, because it was kind of like, oh well, this is gonna go bad anyway, so let's try to like
throw a wrench in. Elephant in the room.
Exactly. And so so we talked about it, and I'm just like, I don't think we want to replicate that again until, like, you know, the end of August, where I go to my writing phase, because I want to go to Mexico to do my writing after my research is done. And so that's the thing about it. We were able to talk about it, and we were able to discuss our feelings. What a concept, right? And so that was more, so there was a little bit of that in there as well, because it was also felt like if we had been, if we had been more in each other's lives at this point, then we could have had a stronger conversation about considering staying together. But we were able to recognize that that wasn't where we were at.
So what, I mean, obviously it ended in a very mature way, but so what sort of feelings, you know, did that bring up for you, and what has the experience been like for you now, you know, being single again?
Oh, they absolutely suck. that's the thing. And it's like, when we talk about life on life's terms, that actually means life is really, really going to suck sometimes. It's going to be absolutely horrible, but we don't have to go and do the things that are self-destructive, that we know are self-destructive, and we don't have to act on, we don't have to act on the laundry list traits. So yeah, but for a while, I mean, I was completely disbalanced, and I try to do what I know is right for me, which is go to meetings, try to help other folks, try to share my message, pray and meditate, do inner child meditations. But you know, I got on the apps.
Yes.
And I started spending money on all the bells and whistles on the apps, and going a little bit crazy with the apps for a little bit. But you know, a program eventually kicked in, and it was like, okay, let's practice acceptance here and accept that you might be alone for a little bit. And then Omicron happened, and it was like, okay, so yeah, like maybe try to slow your crawl a little bit and just get back to you for a while. Because you know, this relationship wasn't like, oh, like this is my plan. It's just gonna happen. When anything involving other people, we really have no control over. We have to do the acceptance. That's the root of our ACA serenity prayer. Accept other people. I have the courage to change the one we can. The wisdom to know that one is me. So that's where I'm at with that. But that's the dirty secret about all 12-step recovery. It doesn't promise that we're going to be all happy all the time. It promises that we can go through absolute shit and we can be okay on the other side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Francisco and I joke around because he'll always talk about how he gets paired up matches with, you know, potential alcoholics on dating apps. And it's amazing. Either everyone out there is an alcoholic or there is just this crazy magnetic chemistry that exists in the apps that brings us to those people. So so what are your intentions going into the new year?
I'm going to keep it low key. I actually, since my birthday is on January 2nd, and I accidentally ran a 5K for the first time in my life. I was never a runner. I was always last when we ran the mile in middle school.
Me too. I always would not go to school that day. I hate running.
Yeah, and I used to absolutely hate it too. And then, in fact, in middle school, again, when I started smoking pot and cutting and just like leaving, I just stopped going to gym. Mm-hmm. One time, me and my friends, we just piled into the car and we were just leaving, and we saw the gym teacher out there in front of the gym, and we just kind of waved to him, and he kind of gave us like one of those like chin nods, like, hey, yo, like just like let us go. But last year I accidentally ran a 5K because I picked the wrong day on the app.
Uh-huh.
And so this year I thought I'd one up myself, and so I'm going to try to do a 10K.
Look at you. When is it?
It's on January 2nd. So that's really my
it's
goal.
It's going to be cold as shit. Where is it?
I'm in Philadelphia.
Yeah. Where are they running it?
Oh no, this is just me. So I'm just gonna I'm just gonna run the Schuylkill Trail.
Uh-huh.
And do a 10K distance.
Nice. So is that just like a long boathouse row? Kind of?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so nice. Finish at the Rocky Steps as you do.
Uh-huh. You have your music.
And so exactly. That's what I'm gonna do for myself. This year, well, who knows? Like this past year has been extremely difficult again. And we didn't mention it, but yeah, I lost my dad to COVID this past year. And you just never know. That's why we live one day at a time. And that's why we stay grateful for today, because today is really all we have. And it's all we can ever experience unless you are some kind of supernatural being that can actually have foresight into what's to come. But I do have goals. I don't want to try to have not to have high expectations, but I have goals, and my goal this year is to finish my research and make a transition to writing, which I want to do in Mexico at my childhood home, because I think that's going to be part of my healing work, is to do something constructive and that will potentially help my people in the long run, because I do feel that that's my life's purpose, and to do it where it all started, and feel the presence of my inner child and do some healing work there as well.
I feel like, just because you brought it up and I feel like it's important, can you talk a little bit about just what the process was with losing your father? And I don't know if there, how you had to practice, you know, the program and principles in handling that.
Well, at the end of the day, it's something that I still have to process and deal with. And I'm actually going into grief counseling on it. So again, going back to the idea of the peak, and we think we've climbed it, and there's another huge one. Well, I just came up to a really big one. And so I'm going to approach it the way I've approached everything. And, this program allowed me not only to navigate that with, I mean, there was trauma for sure. He was intubated for 41 days, and I had to deal with my family the entire time. Mm-hmm. So, but to protect myself from the worst excesses of it, to take time for myself, to know when to say no, and to realize that some of the parts where I couldn't say no it was because that's what I had to do at the time. It was not because I was the family savior. It was not because I had to do it. It's because I chose to do it, because that was the loving thing to do. And that's the best way that this is what I worked the steps for. This is what I did, was in recovery for, is to walk through these things. And at the end of the day, I was able to be there with my dad when he passed. And the further I get from that, the more I realize what a huge gift that was.
Mm.
And this program was what allowed me to do that. And to honor and love him and understand. The beginning of ACA work was realizing that my parents did their best, but that it wasn't good enough. And I was, at the beginning, was focusing on that it wasn't good enough, because we have to move out of the now. We have to face the reality of what happened to us. But now on this side of things, I can focus on that they did their best.
Mm.
And honor that and take the best of that. And, you know, I know that a lot of who I am is because of my parents, not just the bad stuff, but a lot of the good stuff as well. The kindness that my father had, which I feel is one of the things that killed him, because maybe he couldn't tell someone to keep their mask on, or maybe he shouldn't have been working as many jobs as he had, because we're all grown children. And, mm-hmm. You know, he could have like found a way to take care of himself, or just do less for himself, do less for others, do more for himself. And, to know how to be that type of person, but in a way that you still honor and love yourself first and foremost. And that's how I can reconcile what happened and carry it on into whatever comes for me.
Mm-hmm. That is a beautiful note to end on. So thank you so much. I know that this is going to be beneficial for a lot of people, so I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. And yeah, if anything comes out of my experience, it's that if it helps someone, you know, that's what it's all about. That's why we do this.